You are now listening to the Spirits Distilled podcast presented by WSET, the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. For more information on taking a WSET qualification, please visit our website, wsetglobal.com. We hope you will enjoy the program, and if you do, please take a moment to subscribe and rate Spirits Distilled on whatever podcast platform you are coming to us from. Welcome, listeners, to the Spirits Distilled podcast, presented by WSET, the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. I'm Dave Rudman, and I'll be your host for this, the first ever episode of Spirits Distilled, making its world premiere at Tales of the Cocktail 2020. You can expect Spirits Distilled to bring you knowledge and diverse perspectives from WSET's experts, as well as from throughout the world of spirits. We've got a lot of information, we've got a lot of fun planned. Let's get right into it. We start with part one of this episode's main feature, where WSET's Charlie McCarthy, Business Development Manager, Spirits, sits down with two distinguished guests to discuss tasting spirits. We have Elaine Duff, on and off trade strategist, presenter, educator, and spirits judge. Before creating her own company, Duff on the Rocks, she developed and ran the educational programs for ZX Ventures, AB InBev, and 750 bars across five continents, and was the head mixologist and luxury brand ambassador for Diageo Wine and Spirits for 15 years. And we also have Dawn Davies, MW, who started her career working as a head sommelier at many of London's top restaurants, including the Ledbury, which she opened and ran for 2 years. Afterwards, Dawn joined Selfridges as the head wine and spirits buyer, and it was there that Dawn achieved her Master of Wine. She joined Speciality Drinks in 2014 as their head buyer, also running the events team and their three shops. Let's jump right in with Charlie and hear what this panel has to say.
I want to mine the experiences of these fantastic cruise professionals in how they assess spirits and the history of assessing spirits and maybe where it's going in the future. So maybe I'll start with you, Dawn, because you worked and still are a sommelier and you've got your Master of Wine. How did you start approaching assessing spirits, and was it any different when you started approaching spirits? Was it a more free-form thing?
It's a really interesting thing, actually, because my palate's really changed and developed. So I actually find it much easier assessing spirits. I think spirits give you everything much quickly. Much quickly, that's so not a word. Much quicker.
I like it. I'll take it.
You know what? I like to make up words occasionally. So you know, when you're looking for a wine, because actually wine takes a lot longer to evolve in a glass. Yes, spirits 100% evolve in glass. And I think, you know, the more and more we're looking at spirits and understanding spirits and knowing spirits, especially that we're getting more complex spirits out there, the more we do understand that they need time to breathe and kind of open up. And I think that was already around in wine, that concept that they needed to sort of spend a little time in glass. And you know, and I think that's just, it's sometimes it's harder with wines to try and pick up the real nuances and flavors. And so, you know, I was so used to doing all this wine tasting and started tasting spirits properly in Selfridges. I mean, I'd always been interested in spirits. I'd always had a passion for it, but, you know, really Selfridges was where I started doing it. And, you know, and at first it's the alcohol, you know, your palate has to adjust to something that's sort of 12%, 13% max, 20 if you're talking fortified, to like 40 plus, you know. And I remember actually struggling with anything that was cast strength. I was like, oh my God, my palate's dead. You know, when you're used to tasting, say, 100 wines in a competition, that actually now I would never taste more than 40 spirits in one go because your palate gets so much more tired because when the alcohol
absolutely does
to the ABV, you know, like in terms of actual physically on your palate. What is very, very interesting is I still do a lot of wine tasting. I still buy wine for the site, but actually a lot of my wine suppliers, when I do tastings with them, say that my wine tasting has gotten better since I've been doing spirits.
Interesting.
Which I don't have an explanation for. I don't really know. But, you know, I find it a lot easier to kind of pick up a glass and get a lot more nuances out of a spirit very, very quickly. And, you know, like I'll be quite quick on a wine and a spirit tasting note, which I'll probably be slower on a wine tasting note. So
do you think your palate inside your head just expanded because spirits have so much more, you know, there's more flavor and you start to build up that flavor palace in your brain, and going back to wine, you might pick up something that wasn't there before that you didn't notice before.
So I think because spirits, the notes are more obvious because, you know, you have more alcohol to carry them. I think, you know, yes, 100%. You're kind of bam, 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 and then you'll taste something in a wine and be like, hold on, that's what, you know, that ash note that I picked up in Lafroy, suddenly I'm tasting in a wine. But then actually the reverse is true because I often now get sort of red fruit notes, or, you know, I'm super sensitive to anything that's got sulfur or anything that's like got a twinge to it, which actually in spirits, cork as well, in any spirits. It's something that I found quite interesting about my own palate development is now I can just quite happily switch between the two. I can do a wine tasting into a spirit tasting and, you know, I'm fine. But it was, I mean, 10, 12, 13 years now I've been doing it. So if I can't do it now, then we're... I'm allowed to swear on this, by the way, because
I am not going to say no.
Well, you might be in for a treat there because I'm a swearer myself. So I'm going to do my best early.
Elaine, you were working for your consulting mixologist for Delta Airlines for a while. You were working on Ciroc for a while in Tanqueray. Where did you first start becoming analytical when it came to spirits?
I mean, my first training into spirits was I worked on the marketing side for a long time. And when 2005 came and the mixology, you know, the cocktail scene started expanding, I met Steve Olson, who, you know, is really into wine, and we hired him to give us analysis on Tanqueray 10 and to teach us about cocktails. And this was probably like 2003, actually, when he came in, and I said, I want to do what that guy does. And I started tasting things differently, and they created, so in 2005 is when Bar 5 first launched. Mm-hmm. And I knew nothing about spirits, to be honest with you. I didn't know anything about cocktails, but I said, that's what I want to do. And my head was very lucky to have a boss who said, you know, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be Steve Olson. He said, I could totally see you doing that. So he said, what do you need? I said, I need to go to Bar 5. And I went to Bar 5 being completely like a virgin to the industry, knowing really nothing. So tasting things for the first time, just being able to analyze like the difference between, you know, what a tequila smells like versus a gin on the nose. And I was very lucky I had Jim Meehan sitting next to me in my Bar 5 day class. And he really kind of took me underneath his wing, because not only could he tell the difference between the different spirits on his nose, he could tell you what brand was in the glass. Yeah. Because he was constantly tasting things at his bar. So it kind of opened my world. And I learned how to taste there. Like Steve had a very interesting way where we would nose things, identify like what are the key notes you're looking for in a rum or tequila or, you know, a gin, you know, what should you be looking out for? Also what to look for in like barrel types, like is it aged in French oak versus American oak? And for a person who's never done it before, it was a lot, very overwhelming. I also had just had my daughter. So Yes.
I know that's a thing.
It definitely changed. I don't know how, but it definitely changes a little bit. You taste things a little bit differently. And so it was, you know, I was the only person running home to like breastfeed, like in between like breaks, which was an interesting. So needless to say, I didn't pass the first time. But the funny thing is I did pass the nosing test. I passed the nosing, the testing. I just didn't pass the cocktail portion. So they allowed me to come back. Actually, it was very new on. They allowed me to come back for the second time. And next time I nailed it. But working for Diageo, you know, we were kind of just limited to their portfolio. So I just kind of learned how to nose and taste, you know, their, which is a very wide portfolio. But my palate didn't change and I didn't get better until I left. when I really left and I started really tasting other people's brands and spirits, and I worked for AB InBev at the time, actually, I went to work for Anheuser-Busch working in beer, which is a completely different way of tasting things. You know, you don't like move it into your mouth or like it's, you know, it's very different. But my palate got better. Just like you, like switching industries sometimes like kind of opens you up to new nuances in spirit and in flavors you didn't smell before. And my palate. What?
It probably freshens you up a little bit as well. Cause you know, if you're used to tasting one thing and then suddenly you're flipped over, you know, you give your palate a break from the one thing to go into the other thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking
and now I will say, like, now that I'm doing it often, it's like now I find myself I can nail it. You can put things in front of me, I'm like, oh yeah, rum, alcohol, like it just started my palate, my flavor, and being a judge now for American Distilling Institute, you have to like really up your game of like identifying flavor notes and what's off and what's wrong. I can never, sulfur is one I can smell, but I know people are really sensitive to. I can't, it doesn't hit me as hard as other people.
I can hear it. If it's got sulfur, it's funny. Sukinda and I, my boss, were tasting some barrel samples for a TWE barrel sort of exclusive. And I just put my nose in it. I was like, I'm not tasting it. And Sukinda was like, I can't smell it. And it's really interesting. I did a really very, very amazing tasting with the Australian Institute for Wine. And they did this thing where actually you do a whole load of different flavors and smells. And so many people are osmosmic to things. Black pepper, 1 in 10 people can't taste. I was like, black pepper.
Wow. I never knew that.
Super interesting. One of the best tastings I've ever done in my life. And it really showed to me like people's sensitivities, just like,
I'm super, super sensitive to smoke flavors. So when I did the level 3 spirits back in October, WSET, and one of the mezcals we were sampling was something that just came in a bottle with a sticky plaster on it that somebody had just brought back from Mexico. And it was just very, very rustic. But all I could get was ash. That was it. And everybody's going, oh, it's got really interesting layers. I go, I'm just getting ash. Mm. That's pretty, it just dominates my palate so much. But speaking of beer, some exciting news actually got released today. WSET are going to launch level 1 and level 2 in beers.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, so it could be quite exciting. Obviously, the course is in development at the moment. But yeah, stay tuned. It's something I'm very much looking forward to learning more about. Elaine, you mentioned spirits competitions, and I know the one you judge spirits comps as well, and also you have to assess quite a lot of spirits as they get sent into the shop, and I know that you are happy to give people feedback sometimes if that can change,
sometimes they don't want it.
I know you tasted something recently that you were very unimpressed by, but I don't know if we want to discuss that publicly on a podcast.
Yeah, we can. I am open to anything. Yeah, I'll talk.
Okay.
I will name and shame.
So we're going to talk about the judging experience and your technique. How do you plan your day? And then we'll get on to the naming and shaming later. Because it's quite onerous consuming that much alcohol, even if you are spitting. You have to have
quite
It's like for me, if I look at it from sort of two angles, you know, I said when I taste wine, I can taste 100 in a day. And okay, your palate's exhausted because of the tannins and things and the acidities. And potentially if you're chasing champagne or sparkling the bubbles. But, you know, spirits, because that alcohol, like I'm constantly water. Oat cakes are my best friends. I spend a lot of time actually smelling the back of my hand, because that recalibrates your nose. I tend not to ever change my toothpaste brand. I'm not one of these people that really worries too much about food. My palate doesn't seem to really be affected. Spicy, okay, fine. But if I have it the night before, who gives a toss? I wouldn't, you know, maybe go and have like, you know, really spicy Indian before tasting or anything really strong. But yeah, for me, it's just about like continually water, spit, you know, swallow. And yeah, just that constant, just keeping your palate as alive as possible. I also like to, I taste in pods, but you know, like we'll do vodka, then gin, you know, so how you structure your tasting, if you're doing mixed, for me is very important to just identify lighter to heavier flavors and then taste in that way. So, you know, your, the structure of your pan, especially if you're judging, I've judged on a couple of spirit panels where I found that I didn't think they had the lineup correct. And you know, I actually was like, I'm not going to taste that first. I'm going to come back to that because I don't feel, because the lineup for me is also super important. But
So you're not going to start off with Octomore.
You can't start off with a palate buster, as we like to call it. But yeah, I'm a little nerdy in the fact that I, before I know I'm going to a spirits judging competition, like I kind of like prep myself because I never know a spirit. So like I'll start tasting at home, like nosing a bunch of stuff at home just to get my, kind of calibrate in my head. Okay, so I'm looking for these notes, especially as something I don't drink very often, like Pisco or something like that. Like I haven't tasted a Pisco in a long time. So I'm like, let me just go back to tasting one that I know is a standard and like what flavor notes I'm pairing in my brain. I also like no perfumes, you know, like very natural soap.
Yeah. For about 25 years.
I have never noticed.
Yeah. Must just smell naturally. Lovely. Tons of water, as you said, and definitely back of my hand. I also smell my paper because the paper, to kind of neutralize my nose. Like I do that a lot. I'm kind of like, I'll just smell the paper and get that kind of, and it's really, usually taste when I've done some of the spirit, like we'll taste the same thing. Like it's all in the one morning, it's just all whiskey, you know, and it's just different levels of whiskey. And then like the end of the day, we'll do like a palate buster before lunch. And it might be something completely different. It's not whiskey. It's like a liqueur or something like that to really kind of recalibrate yourself and to kind of like really assess something. But it is, it's hard. Like you do have to take that break and stay. For me, I do have to stay very neutral flavors when I'm eating food. It's not a very exciting lunch or a very exciting breakfast. And also making sure I eat a lot because you do get a little loopy.
Hungry. I get like super hungry. Yes. Halfway through, I'm like, give me some crackers now. Like, canter lines. Like, I literally have a pile of like cars crackers, and I'm like, no.
And I am a fan of like, we have longer time to assess because sometimes they go too fast. Like, I'll be at a set table and there's 10 of us, and some people are faster than others. And like, I really want that time, but you feel bad. You don't want to hold people up, but I want to make sure I'm doing the right job and really taking the time with it. I'm a slow noser and a taster. So. But I try not to. So I'd rather less than more.
Tasting's quite interesting. I think, you know, it's very easy to sit by yourself and assess. You know, that's, you know, quick. It's easy. You're just tasting. I write tasting notes for everything. When I judge, everything gets a tasting note because that allows me to kind of really think through the product. But I think when you're in a panel, you have to calibrate first because then you have to understand when you're scoring together who likes certain styles, who doesn't, and get yourself to a balance. And, you know, I always say when I'm judging, there's a couple of things. Like, one, you're not judging what you, like, you have to
what
think.
You like.
I'm a customer. So if I like a drier style of whatever, or I don't really love flavored gin or what have you, I have to think, but actually, is this good for my consumer? Who is the consumer this is going towards, and what am I tasting? And then the other thing to really, really remember, and I get so pissed off with people that do this, is that by the time you're sort of halfway through your tasting day, the thing that's going to stand out and seem like the best product is the stuff with the most flavor. That's when you have to say to yourself, no, this isn't the good product. Actually, let me go and really look at that little guy that's not really popping in the glass because my palate's tired. And people just often in competitions, and this is why I don't really hold a lot of weight with competitions, even though I judge a lot, is that, you know, when I'm looking at product, I don't take into account competitions. Is because I know if you've got a panel and someone's just like, you know, a big Parker wine comes along and it's a lot of fruit and whatever, next to that really elegant kind of Burgundy, it's going to look bad. So you've really got, especially when your palate is tired, go back and really look at the guys that are not showing in your head to the best of their ability. And that's something I'm very vehement about when I judge.
That's, yeah, no, myself, it's like, I like to go back, like I'll make a little note and like, I judge, like we have really specific sheets, like, you know, judging like, okay, what do I taste? And if I tasted an off flavor or something that was not right, or I am like, I'll make a little note and then I will sit for a minute, drink some water. And then like, all right, I'm going to go back to that one and really analyze it again, because because sometimes you're like, oh, this is amazing. Yeah. And then you realize like, and then you go and you taste other ones. You're like, oh, maybe that wasn't so amazing. Yeah. And you have to go back and like, yeah. And look at it and recalibrate it. Cause then you see what the other ones are tasting like in the same category. And you're like, what was I really, maybe that was just refreshing. Yeah. So you have to go back and really look at it again and taste it again and give yourself a moment and be like, all right, let's like just sit and like, let it sit for a second, maybe put some water in it to kind of open it up a little bit more, maybe bring down the proof. And then you're like, I'm actually tasting that note I didn't taste before. And it wasn't really that great. It's hard.
Yeah, it is. It's going back and forth a little bit. It's people don't be afraid to go back and forth. You know, I think that's the thing. If you, I always like, if I have a row of glasses, I'll put like the ones I like out. Mm-hmm. Like, the ones I don't like, I just go, meh. Yeah. Because sometimes you just know straight down. No,
yeah, you just knows it. You know, it. You're like, that's, yeah.
But yeah, then the ones that I like, I kind of pull out and then I go back, meh. Okay, which one would I? And it's like, again, yeah, it's calibration, isn't it?
Yeah, I try to analyze them all on their own merits. Like, so it's not like this one's better than this one. It's just like, is that a good whiskey or is that a good gin? Is that a quality? Then this is my rating. This is what a good quality spirit tastes like.
Yeah. Now, speaking of that assessment, feel free to reveal as little or as much as you'd like to this next question. Obviously, within a competition, there's a score sheet and a matrix that they want you to score towards. But when you're just assessing... outside of that, just in your own general practice, whether it's looking at a new brand, what sort of methodology do you know? I mean, I know, Elaine, you did the pilot for the Level 3 Spirits mm-hmm. a while ago, and there's with the systematic approach, it's very, it's quite a regimented systematic approach. What, in your own day-to-day, have you got I'm assuming you've got a very strict methodology that you follow and you use?
I don't know if it's strict, but there's definitely a methodology to it. I mean, I'm very lucky to have like Philip and I are both in the industry, so we'll taste things together, which is kind of interesting. And we have very different palates of what we like and what we don't like. And we argue sometimes. So I'll be like, that's crap. And I'll think it's amazing. So it's like taking, but it is very much of like looking at it, nosing it, knowing what the benchmark is in my brain. Like there's definitely benchmark spirits that you kind of develop and you're like, no, this is what, and then, but also recognize that there's a nuance, like, all right, this is what benchmark is, but they're trying something different. So like, are they achieving what they're trying? It's like, so I kind of try to keep that. It's a consumer brain. I also try to put myself in the seat of the consumer, knowing I'm a mixologist. I drink differently. I'm a spirits person. I like boozy, strong drinks, right? And so you have to kind of put yourself on a neutral palate. And it's like, I look at it, I do the same thing I would do if I was in like the WSC. I use kind of multiple methods. So I use like Steve's method, which I was taught, which is like, you know, I nose it, I make a note of what I'm smelling, I put it in my mouth, I rinse it around my mouth, I breathe through my nose to engage the back palate. I let it sit there for a couple of seconds. And then if it's really nice and I'm at home, I'll just swallow. If not, it's spitting out. But it really is just kind of like, you know, assessing like, where's my benchmark? Is it hitting those notes that I'm looking for? You know, and just, is it, you know, how does it taste on the palate? And then I make a cocktail with it. How's it work in a cocktail to kind of really see, is it standing up? Like if I'm doing the rum, the first thing I did when this Campari rum was I put it in a daiquiri like straight away. I was like, does it hold up in a daiquiri? And that's kind of for me, my little methodology of.
Yeah, I think that's
I do that when you're at a competition.
That's kind of job number one for most rums, isn't it? Like, are you a good daiquiri rum?
Yeah, it really is. Even though the consumer still has no idea what a daiquiri is, they still think it's a frozen drink. They get
oh no! In the UK, we are daiquiri central right now. I'm
so happy.
Big home cocktails. Like I'm looking at my sales, going, they're making daiquiris.
That's good news.
And there's a real move towards the kind of super funky style, like the Clarins style and the Hamden style as well in the UK at the moment.
Clarins, I'm obsessed. I mean, actually, I think I should become the brand ambassador for Clarins because for once in my life, someone said to me, like for years, I've been asked, what's your desert island drink? You know, like, and I'm like, I can't tell you because I love Riesling and Nebbiolo and all that. Now I'm like, Clarins Seju.
Yeah, it's delicious.
And
Yeah.
No hope for me.
Yeah, I don't know. The brand ambassador, Dean McGregor, came to WSET and gave us a private tasting of the range, and it was like everybody was just...
Dean's amazing. I want Dean's job.
I think everybody wants your job, though, and that's the thing.
Well, I think that Charlie and Dawn are right on this one. There are so many cool jobs out there that involve tasting spirits, and I'm just loving this conversation between WSET's Charlie McCarthy, Elaine Duff, and Dawn Davies, MW, on tasting spirits. We'll get back to it in part two in just a bit. But before we do that, and speaking of Desert Island Drinks, we've got a feature for you called Desert Island Drinks, where we answer the drinks world's most famous small talk question. If you were stranded on a desert island and could have only one drink, what would it be? Well, we at Spirits Distilled have put a slight twist on the question and are inquiring of our guests, what would be your one sipping spirit, your one mixing spirit, and naturally, we want to know everyone's guilty pleasure drink. In this first edition of Desert Island Drinks, we pose the question to Russell Burgess, Managing Director of Wet & Dry, a drinks consulting company based in the UK, and here's what he had to say.
Hello there. My name is Russell from the consultancy company Wet & Dry, and I'm here to choose three Desert Island drinks. My sipping spirit would have to be Appleton Estate 12-year-old. Price point wise, it's around 30 quid, and you will not get anything with as much bang for your buck as that. It's because it's Jamaican, as am I originally. It's got a lot of rules and regulations, so there's no sugar added, no caramel. It's all natural flavorings and it's well nice. Second desert island drink is going to be a mixing spirit. I'd probably have to go with bathtub gin here. It's cold compounded, so it's got extra juniper and orange, cardamom, cloves and cinnamon added to it afterwards. So it's really, really powerful gin. So it's not lost when you're mixing it in things as simple as a gin and tonic or a white lady, which I also love. And then thirdly, my guilty pleasure would probably have to be a Calimocho. That is a delicious blend of red wine, equal parts red wine and Coca-Cola, originated in Spain in the 1970s. If you ask for that in a bar, people kind of look at you a bit funny perhaps, but it's just really tasty, served over ice, long, refreshing. Also, obviously, the better the red wine, the better the drink tastes. So trying to use an expensive red wine with Coca-Cola, again, people are like, oh no. But tasty ass.
Wow, a Calimocho? That's one you definitely don't hear every day. But on your recommendation, Russell, I might just have to go out and reacquaint myself with one real soon. Thanks, Russell, so much for providing us with your desert island drinks. Now, let's get back into part two of our main conversation about tasting spirits with WSET's Charlie McCarthy, Elaine Duff, and Dawn Davies, MW.
At what stage do you or do you ever add water when you're assessing a spirit?
I add it more whiskey. I do just to see how it stands up, but only normally if I feel that more with single casks. I do that just because if we're Skin and I are choosing single casks, sometimes we usually bottle cask strength, but sometimes we just want to see if we bring it down a bit, actually something that may not quite have been right if we just bring it down a couple of degrees. I only really add water if I just want to see if it opens up. I'm so impressed with your methodology because mine is like so not that robust at all. I mean, like, I'm going to go back and start retasting everything. and maybe because I've been doing this for over 20 years that maybe am a little lax now.
I'm a nerd.
I always write to it. My methodology is basically tasting note and assessing because I'm assessing on very different levels. So I'm one assessing is this something I can retail? In which case there's other things I'm taking, not just the liquid in the glass. Okay, the liquid in the glass is the most important thing and it's got to be balanced. Whatever it is, it's got to be balanced. Balance, balance, balance. But I also have to understand that, you know, I have consumers that want to drink stuff that I would never want to drink. I could name some brands now, but I won't. I'll be very good. I behave myself once in my life. But, you know, so packaging is hugely important as an example. I also then have to look at it from a perspective of our on-trade side. So I have to think, okay, this may not be a product that I really necessarily like, but is there enough demand in the on-trade for it? And also, is this something that's going to be an addition, not necessarily a standalone product?
What I'm going to say the best to last. The best is I'm going to ask you each to name something that really blew you away and you were super impressed with, and then tell me a story about something that was horrible. You can or cannot name the brand as you wish. But before that, can you tell me each of, can you share with us what you have in your glasses there?
Oh, sure. Well, yeah, I guess we reshare. So mine is a Roma Agricole called Capale from Belize. I really like it. It's clean, it's pure. They don't use anything else in it. It's just sugar, yeast and water. You know, it's just a very clean, pure spirit, and they're really into giving back to their community. And it makes an excellent, excellent daiquiri.
I haven't heard of an Agricole from Belize before.
It's one of the few, and they only can make their sustainability practices are, you know, I knew they weren't full of shit. Because some people talk about their sustainability and talk about they're only going to, you know, when I saw how many cases they're able to make, they're not making this many. They just let you know straight up front that they can only make 400,000 bottles a year. And that's when you know somebody's telling the truth. Because when somebody says they're being sustainable and they're doing all things like the pure way, but they can make it 2 million cases, I'm like, yeah, no. Like, obviously, are using maybe some other things you're not talking about, or maybe it's not all made there and you really are making it in 5 different locations, even though we only see this, because there's no way those 8 stills are putting out that much liquid in a year. So that's when I knew these guys were legit. So I'm excited to work with them as well.
I'm also rumming away, and I'm very lucky today because I figured I needed a treat because it's halfway through the week. I'm drinking Hamden Great House, which Hamden is an amazing distillery in Jamaica. It's super high ester rum, all, you know, natural fermentation, long-ass fermentations, which give you so much flavor on the palate. A lot of kind of muck pit influenced underpits, mm-hmm. and you're getting really big, big, powerful esters. And this is Great House, which is one there. Sort of limited releases, and I was fortunate enough to snaffle a bottle when it came in.
Is that
I'm working
released?
My way through it.
Is that released by Le Maison Valier, or is it
Luca worked with Great House to basically with Hamden to kind of release a Hamden range, because traditionally in the past Hamden never really did much with their own brand. They were selling a lot of their product to different distilleries to add that little kind of kick of flavor. But, you know, really Hamden's coming to life. And if you like big flavors, I always say Hamden's a bit like Marmite. You know, you love it or you hate it. But when you love it, you really love it.
Yeah.
So my friend Mitch says that actually a little bit of Hamden and a daiquiri always works a treat.
Just a little of.
Just a little squish. But actually Angelo at Valier makes the best Hamden daiquiris. So I can go.
Okay, fair enough. I got introduced to the idea that I think it's only Hamden that still do muck pits in Jamaica.
There are others that have muck pits, but they're the ones that are really, I mean, Worthy Park doesn't, Acton doesn't, as far as I'm aware. But yeah, I mean, these are
They use Dunder to a certain extent, but I think it's like, Hamden is like...
No, the proper muck pit, Hamden.
Yeah. I was gonna say the one thing I found interesting, I would love to know, because I didn't know this until I started working with this brand, about the sugar cane and how they add different flavors. Like this one is made with red and black sugar cane, and they picked it very specifically. they tested out multiple different sugarcane varietals in Belize. And this is how they came. They wanted everything to come directly from the sugarcane itself, like all the flavor, and not use anything else. So that's why they don't have any, they didn't have the dunder or the muck pits. It's not their style. Because I do love a big ester. And yeah, so they use very specific, which I thought was really kind of interesting, like to really choose that. And it's basically a red and black, different types of sugarcane.
It's super interesting, actually. I actually really believe that after wine and agave spirits, that sugarcane juice-based rums definitely have a sense of terroir, you know, Aran especially, and they all use sort of very native juice. And, you know, you look at the agricoles from Martinique, again, they're sort of, they're defined by what kind of canes that they can use and stuff. So it's super interesting. I could talk about rum for the rest of my life. So
yes.
I know. Yeah, it's supposed to be the whiskey exchange, though.
No, no. We changed it to the wine and rum exchange a while back.
Wonderful. So I think we're going to wrap it pretty soon, but I do want to hear from you an example of heaven and an example of hell is something that you tasted for the first time. You don't have to brand call, but just kind of give us a bit of a hint of what notes you picked up.
My definition of hell is flavored whiskey. I really, really, I really hate flavored whiskey. I'm like, why did you have to ruin something that's so amazing? Because whiskeys, I love all spirits. I really enjoy my whiskey. My heaven is definitely a really good bottled and bond, you know, Tennessee whiskey. I will say, and I will name a brand. One of my favorite brands in the world is Dickel. And their bottled and bond is one of my favorite spirits of all time. I mean, that it just, it's perfect. And I love the distiller, Nicole. But yeah, I tasted that and I was like, there was a reason why you won an award. It was before that won the award. I just fell in love. It's an incredible spirit, but I really do. I love bottled and bond whiskeys. I love bourbons. But flavored whiskey, when you start adding flavors like cinnamon and bubblegum and straw, it makes me cry.
Yeah.
and the amount of sugar that goes into the flavored whiskeys as well is.
Oh yeah. But now people are just doing, they're adding like, you know, all sorts of things because they're trying to, they're very young age whiskeys. And the other thing is a lot of distillers here they're trying to age it faster. So they use much smaller barrels and they're so tannic and it's just like, it's like licking a piece of wood. It's awful and it's just, it doesn't work and they just keep doing it. And I keep writing notes like, stop doing this, please stop doing this. You know, use a bigger, invest in that bigger barrel. I know it's a lot of money, but just do it. It will pay off in the future.
Okay.
So that's my help.
We're going to be doing a separate episode on maturation. So I'm going to carry that note over and use it as a discussion topic.
Start me on oak. I'll be here for another hour and a half. No, I'm with you. I think, you know, there's a lot of flavored shit out there. My heaven, I think one of the brands I'm probably one of the most proud of, Capriolis. I discovered Barney a while back and with his Garden Tiger Gin, now Garden Swift. And I just fell in love with him, the packaging, the product, everything. And his eau de vies with Capovia in Italy are the best in the world. I mean, they're insanely beautiful eau de vies. And every time I phone him, he's in like a barrel of fruit treading. Seedlip actually is another brand I'm super proud that I launched in the UK. I remember Ben coming into my office and I was like, "It's gonna, what are you talking about? No alcohol. I don't do no alcohol." And I tasted it and I was like, no, I think this is super interesting. And I immediately got on the phone to a load of my bartender friends. I was like, you need to take this. And Ben kind of emailed me and he goes, I'm sitting in the cafe downstairs in Selfridges and I haven't stopped shaking because you've just agreed to take on a pallet. Like, I was his first sale, which is super nice. Plenty, plenty. I think there's too many flavored rums out there now. I think people are, again, it's like the whiskey bandwagon. Let's not kill flavored rum, people. You know, like, I don't want to have a gin. I could keep going for about several decades. Lobster gin was one of my favorites. The one that Charlie was referring to that was last week's beauty was a horse milk vodka. Yeah, that made me actually physically vomit. So,
Wow. That should be the tagline.
This will make you physically, vomit. You're looking to vomit?
In my life that have made me physically vomit, and that was one of them. So, I'm quite happy to name and shame because I have...
Fair enough. Well, on that delicious note, I think maybe we should call it a day. Thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you and, more importantly, listening to what you have to say. And we will look forward to continuing these conversations over the series of the rest of the podcast. Cheers.
Well, this is great. Cheers. Lovely to meet you.
Pleasure.
Cheers. Thank you. Thanks, Charlie.
There you have it, folks. That's Tasting Spirits, according to two of the world's preeminent spirits experts, Elaine Duff and Dawn Davies, MW. Thank you so much to our distinguished guests for sitting down with WSET's Charlie McCarthy for this incredible conversation, and I can't think of a better way for WSET to kick off its Spirits Distilled podcast. All right, folks, now before the end of our program, we have another feature that we like to do. It's called Letter to My Younger Self, where we ask some of the spirits world's most experienced and successful players to let us know what advice they would give themselves when they were first getting started on their journey. In this edition, we asked an icon in the spirits world, Richard Patterson, who's been the master blender at White & Mackay for, get this, folks, over 50 years. I can't wait to hear what he had to say.
So, Richard, you want to become a master blender. Well, let me tell you, life's tough out there. So here's a few points you must remember. First of all, you must have dogged determination if you want to achieve your objectives. Then, passion. Passion elevates the soul to achieve greater things. Never forget that. More importantly, you must have knowledge. As Sir Francis Bacon said way back when... on the 24th of March, 1603, when King James I came to the throne, he said, your majesty, knowledge is power. So please remember that. More importantly, you must have a big nose. You must have a nose. You must use it. Because when you approach a whiskey, it's going to tell you everything you need to know. But you must do it slowly. So let me just tell you, first of all, I don't want you to hold the glass like this. I don't want you to start warming it in a stupid way like that. And the third thing is, I don't want you to see you nosing like this. What I want you to do is to swirl the glass around, come up to it and say, hello, and then go back and say, how are you? And then come back and say, quite well, thank you very much. Now you've got two nostrils, make sure you make full use of them, but go into it and take your time. And when it comes to tasting, and let it go down. Don't knock it back like a cowboy. Put it in the top of the tongue, underneath the tongue, and back in the middle. The longer you keep it in the mouth, the better. That will more attract all these lovely flavours and nuances and everything else. So take your time. The other thing I want you to do is to use your nose when you're about. Smell the wind, smell the rain, smell the supermarket. When you go into a warehouse, is it a damp warehouse, is it a dry warehouse? Take your time. So important, use your nose properly. But also I want you to be kind to people, considerate, compassionate to young people and to old people. And also, please, don't be negative. Always be positive, even when things go up and down and down and down. Remain determined to rise above the occasion and make it happen. And remember, the Scotch whisky industry and the wine industry will be good to you. Give it back. Try and give something back to it. Always remember that. And if you can remember all these things, you'll be fantastic.
What can I say, people? The man, the myth, the legend, Richard Patterson. Thank you so much, Richard, for sharing your wisdom with our listeners here at Spirits Distilled. And that's all for episode one of the Spirits Distilled podcast presented by WSET, the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. We hope you look forward to episode two, where we'll feature a seriously deep and nerdy conversation about yeast and fermentation with another all-star cast of guests. Until then, cheers from WSET. Thanks for listening to the Spirits Distilled podcast presented by WSET, the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. Please remember that the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WSET. If you enjoyed this program, please take a moment to subscribe and rate Spirits Distilled on whatever podcast platform you are coming to us from. For more information on taking a WSET qualification, please visit our website, wsetglobal.com.